Are Latinos the decisive abortion access vote? Are those new school bus cameras tainted by corruption? And are Cubans ever going to come out of the dark? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the all-out outreach to Latino voters on Florida's Amendment 4 and other abortion access ballot measures across the country. Will Latinos be the issue's swing vote? We'll also look at the controversial company and candidate behind the admittedly popular new school bus traffic cameras now used in Miami-Dade County. And we'll look at the causes and the possible fallout of Communist Cuba's chronic blackout nightmare. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Amendment 4 is arguably the most contentious question on the Florida ballot. If it passes, it would make access to abortion before fetal viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health, as the proposal is worded, a state constitutional right. The measure is a response to what critics call the near-total abortion ban that took effect in Florida this year, which largely bans the procedure after only 6 weeks of pregnancy. Amendment 4 needs 60% of the vote to win out, and polls show it will be close. So those who support constitutional abortion access are looking for a swing vote, and that bloc is likely Latinos. Some might associate Latinos with Roman Catholic opposition to abortion, but a new AP poll actually shows 67% of Latinos oppose abortion bans. The question is whether that applies to Florida Latinos. Pro-abortion rights groups are betting it does, and in recent weeks they put ads on the Spanish language airwaves, especially here in South Florida, urging Latinos to vote yes on Amendment 4. Are you a Latino who's decided or undecided on the abortion amendment? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now are two leaders of the push to persuade Latinos to vote for Amendment 4. Gloria Romero Rosas is on the Florida board of the abortion rights nonprofit Catholics for Choice, which has produced many of the pro-Amendment 4 radio spots here. Daniela Martins is a reproductive health access expert here and in Latin America, and also a vice chair of the Women's Emergency Network Clinic in Coral Gables. Thank you to you both for being with us.
Thank you,
and
Tim.
I'll just let people know we'll also be hearing a little later some remarks from my interview with one of the country's leading Latino opponents of the abortion access measures like Amendment 4, which are also on the ballot in other states with large Latino populations like Arizona and Nevada. Gloria Romero Rosas, let me start with you because your nonprofit, Catholics for Choice, has really led this media campaign to persuade Florida Latinos to vote for Amendment 4. As I mentioned, a lot of people might consider that a quixotic task because they think Latinos, they think Catholic, they think anti-abortion. But that's not actually the case. How would you describe the Latino mindset on abortion rights, and why do you think they'll turn out to be the decisive vote on Amendment 4?
Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate you giving us the opportunity to dialogue about this issue. When Catholics for Choice partnered with Mi Vecino on a phone banking operation to call Latino Catholics throughout Miami and Orlando.
And Gloria, we should please tell us again, Mi Vecino, that's a nonprofit much like yours, yes?
Yes, Mi Vecino is a civic engagement nonprofit that works throughout Florida talking with Latinos about why it's important to vote and also to register.
Okay.
So in that phone banking operation, we asked them about the importance of protecting family decisions, and 84.5% of them supported being able to protect their family making decisions without government interference. And what I think is incredibly heartening for us when we think about how Hispanic voters sometimes are taken for granted in campaigns, 75.5% of them are aware of Amendment 4, and they intend to vote on this issue. Mm-hmm. So Catholics, right, and specifically Latino Catholics, are the future of the church and of Florida. And when we look at the reality of who is being impacted by the extreme abortion bans. Latino Catholics know very clearly that their wives, their mothers, their daughters, their sisters are all potentially at risk when you have such an extreme measure undermining their ability to make that decision with their family, their faith, and their
But
doctors.
Gloria, there are Latinos and then there are Florida Latinos who, at least in South Florida, tend to be much more conservative on issues like abortion than non-Florida Latinos like Puerto Ricans in New York or Mexicans in California. So while 67% of Latinos nationally may support abortion rights, in Florida, a recent Florida International University poll found only 36% of Latinos opposed the state's new 6-week abortion ban, while 27% were undecided. Is there a bigger challenge here when it comes to persuading Latinos to support the expanded abortion access that Amendment 4 promises?
I think what we have found in our conversations with voters is that the majority of Catholics in Florida are pro-choice because of their faith and not in spite of it. You know, when we look at the very deep social justice thread that runs in our faith, Florida Catholics are no different than any other Catholic. We want to ensure
But Gloria, I was asking specifically about Florida Latinos. Is there a bigger challenge when you're trying to persuade Florida Latinos on this issue?
No, I don't believe so. Because again, the conversations that we've been having at Doors, Florida Latinos, whether they're Catholic or Christian of other denominations, fundamentally agree that the decision, as difficult as it may be, is between them, their family, their doctor, and their faith. It is not to be, frankly, a function of government interference.
Daniela Martins, you also worked on the Spanish language Amendment 4 ads. From your own work as a reproductive health access expert, why do you feel Latinos could be the vote that makes or breaks Amendment 4 next month?
It's been a very interesting election cycle because we're seeing, while we are seeing that Latinos in Florida are, like you mentioned, leaning more conservative, abortion seems to be the exception of this. So every time that we talk to Latinos in Florida, the second that they are becoming aware of the extreme abortion ban that is currently in place since May, their instance on abortion immediately shifts. A lot of them actually self-identify as pro-life themselves. They wouldn't have an abortion if they needed one. That wouldn't be a decision they would make. However, they also self-identify as pro-choice. These are not dichotomies among Latinos, in Florida.
I also wanted to ask you, Daniela, what effect the recent trend toward legalization of abortion in Latin America, with movements like the Green Wave, for example, has had on the outlook toward abortion among Latinos here. In recent years, we've seen three of the region's largest countries, Mexico, Argentina, and Colombia, legalize the procedure. The region as a whole is still admittedly very restrictive on abortion, but how strongly have the changes down there resonated here, do you think?
Very much so. Anecdotally, I've spoken with a Colombian woman this week and with an entire Argentinian family just yesterday while I was knocking on doors in Hialeah. And they both talked about the processes in their countries, which was very unique to me. And they both mentioned that they weren't passionate about the issue, but that they found it in impressive that they had to vote on this issue because they were certain that abortion was legal in the United States and that people weren't dying, bleeding out in clinics the way that they remember it happening in their countries before.
Which brings us, Gloria and Daniela, to one of the radio spots that I wanted to play. Let's take a listen to the start of one of the Spanish language radio spots that Catholics for Choice produced.
Soy la doctora Cecilia Grande, soy católica y llevo 30 años practicando medicina como ginecobstetra. Esta ley extrema que prohíbe el aborto en la Florida está en conflicto con la ética médica y mi conciencia. Aunque esta ley dice tenerse.
So this woman, Dr. Cecilia Grande, is a Florida gynecologist. She makes a point of saying she's a Catholic, but she says Florida's current 6-week abortion ban is, quote, extreme and in conflict with medical ethics and her own conscience. She then goes on to say that the Florida law makes it almost impossible for doctors to give women the reproductive health care they need, especially women with pregnancy complications, and that this can end up being deadly. Gloria, this isn't that different from the English language pro-Amendment 4 ads we've seen recently. What is perhaps different about the message that groups like yours are trying to get across to Latinos?
Well, I think for Florida Catholic Latinos, it's important to get a reality check because unfortunately the bishops in Florida have been distorting the current reality of Florida's extreme abortion ban. The fear-mongering that my friends and family are telling me they hear from the pulpit on Sundays is really disconcerting about the intention of Amendment 4 and the reality that as it currently stands, women's health is absolutely at risk by the 6-week ban that's in place. Okay. So I think for us, having the ability to provide someone like Dr. Granda the platform to share not just her professional opinion and experience with the current 6-week ban, but the fact that she, as a woman of faith, mm-hmm. can absolutely be pro-choice because of that faith and not in spite of it.
Daniela, does this message perhaps resonate more with Latino women and families because the Latino community in general, much like the Black community, has felt itself shortchanged when it comes to healthcare access in general in this country?
Yes, that's right. From the Women's Emergency Network, we see how Latinas are disproportionately impacted by the extreme abortion ban. And we've seen in other states that have these types of abortion bans, maternal mortality rates have skyrocketed, and they're even higher among Latinas. Mm-hmm. So we know as a community that we're more vulnerable now. Yeah. Pregnant Latinas could have a miscarriage. They could have a complication, and they may need an abortion to save their lives from a hemorrhage or from an infection. Mm-hmm. And right now, these bans are delaying the treatment, and they're putting our lives at stake.
So I want to step back here and point to one thing the gynecologist asserts in that Spanish radio ad that we just heard. She says, esta ley que prohíba el aborto en la Florida, meaning Florida law now prohibits abortion, essentially. I spoke this week with Maida Rodriguez, a Mexican-American pro-life activist in Arizona who is also Catholic. She's a Latino community spokesperson for the nonprofit Moms for America. Rodriguez has been traveling around the country, including Florida, urging Latinos to vote against measures like Amendment 4 and similar ballot questions in states like Arizona and Nevada. And I actually caught her while she was in Wisconsin. Rodriguez says she realizes most Latinos support at least limited abortion rights, but she took exception to Latinos being told that states like Florida ban abortion.
Sadly, I do agree that majority of Latinos do favor limited abortion access, but that's not what they're proposing with those Amendment 4 and Question 6 in Nevada and Prop 139 in Arizona. And that's exactly the deceiving part from their side. They're telling the Latinos that an abortion ban is happening in Arizona, and that's not true. Latinos, we're very protective of our family and our children, right? And I think that they know that if they were to put abortions already available for 15 weeks in Arizona, the majority of Latinos will be like, there's no need for any more, right? And we saw it in Florida. Latinos were okay with that 6-week ban. The Hispanic community sees abortion to need to be limited to the first trimester. And that's why they make lies, making people think that there is no abortions happening and women are dying from miscarriages or bleeding to death, being pregnant without abortion being available. And that's why I work so hard with the Latino community, because I know that we will make the difference.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Gloria Romero Rosas of Catholics for Choice and reproductive access expert Daniela Martins about the heavy Latino outreach on Florida's Amendment 4. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Gloria and Daniela, I want you to respond to what Myra Rodriguez was asserting there. But first, speaking of callers, I want to go to Dan from West Palm Beach. Dan, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts about this?
I'm a Catholic, and I'm for the amendment. I'm a pro-choice Catholic. I have three ladies that are my neighbors. They're all very devout Catholics, and they're the ones that were really pushing to support this amendment.
Okay. Well, thanks for that perspective, Dan. We appreciate it. Gloria Romero Rosas, I just wanted to ask you to respond to Myra Rodriguez's complaint that I played there before, that pro-abortion rights groups like yours, Catholics for Choice, are misleading Latinos with the assertion that states like Florida ban abortion today outright, when in fact it is provided, but provided with limitations that she says Latinos actually support. And I should mention that Ms. Rodriguez is not altogether correct when she says that Florida Latinos support the state's six-week abortion ban. As I mentioned, according to the FIU poll, a very slim plurality actually opposes it. But again, Gloria, what is your response to Myra Rodriguez's assertions there?
I think it's important for folks to realize that the information that's being provided to voters is in the language of the amendment itself. And when we look at what we have currently today, and we have many stories of women expressing the reality that 6 weeks, very rarely does a woman know that they are expecting. And that in itself creates hurdles. So when we look at the exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother, you also have additional hurdles. If it's rape or incest, you need to have a police report. If it's for the life of the mother, the language is so vague, as Dr. Granda, an OBGYN, stated in her 60-second radio spot that you played, it's very difficult for that doctor to not feel like they are going to potentially be subject to legal proceedings because of how that is going to be interpreted and making a decision about what is truly at risk for the mother's life. Every pregnancy is unique, and right. I think that's what we're trying to say.
Daniela Martins, what is your response to Ms. Rodriguez's belief that Latinos will end up voting against measures like Amendment 4 because, as she said, while they may support abortion rights like the rest of America, they support it in much more limited ways than the rest of the country does?
You know, it's very disheartening for me when I hear so much disinformation from people from my own community. I would actually invite Ms. Rodriguez to come with me for one day in Florida and to see how many women get denied attention because 6 weeks starts counting from the first day of your last menstrual period. And so by the time that any clinic will actually perform an abortion, it's 5 weeks and something because they need an ultrasound in the state of Florida. And then there's the second appointment because we have a 24-hour waiting period in the state of Florida. So the hurdle is someone needs to, one, be able to even realize that they're pregnant on something that is around 6 to 9 or 10 days after conception. It's right. Very little.
Okay.
Then go to the clinic and then get two different types of appointments in that very little time.
Okay.
The amount of with tears in their eyes that get denied abortions every single day in Florida.
Daniela, excuse me, I'd like to go to another caller. We have Sophia from Miami, who believes that there is a lot of misleading information in the wording of Amendment 4. Sophia, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Are you yourself a Latina?
I am. I'm a Latina, and I'm also part of the Catholic community, and I actually think you misunderstood what I was trying to say there. I think there's a lot of misleading information from people like Ms. Rodriguez, who just spoke about Latinos preferring to end abortions at the first trimester. And I think there's two things to consider here. First of all, not all abortions are just, a family planning decision. As the doctors have commented and your speakers have commented today, a lot of those decisions are made because you are in a life-threatening situation and a non-viable pregnancy. And so you can't just sometimes let the body do what it needs to do, right? You need medical intervention. And very oftentimes those things are not found out within that six-week ban. And that six-week ban is extreme because, as Danielle was just mentioning, it is very difficult to get an appointment with any OBGYN before 8 weeks, and I speak from personal experience.
Right.
So most likely you're not even going to be seen by a doctor then, which automatically closes the door if your situation is a family planning or otherwise decision.
Okay. Well, Sophia, thank you very much for calling in on this. We appreciate your perspective, and I apologize if I mischaracterized your intent there. Gloria, in the 30 seconds we have left, could you respond to Sophia's comment there?
I think it speaks for itself. The ballot summary language is clear. No law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by a healthcare provider. And this amendment does not change a legislature's constitutional authority to require notification to a parent or guardian before a minor has an abortion. Okay. So long as our Latino Catholics continue to remain informed, as I think they have proven to be so, they will be able to read this plain language and make a decision that is going to reflect their belief that this decision, as morally complex as it is, should be made between a woman, her husband, her spouse, her family, her faith, and her doctor.
Okay, I just need to step in before we accept. Daniela, she mentioned Latino Catholics. A lot of talk about Latino Catholics, but a lot of Latinos today are evangelicals, and evangelicals can tend to be even more conservative on abortion than Catholics. What about that nature of this? Are Latino Catholics or evangelicals, excuse me, Daniela, a bigger challenge for this push on your part?
While we see in the numbers of Latino evangelicals that the support is a little bit lower than with Catholics, we still see even among evangelicals that they are within the people, the evangelical people that agree with a full ban are the vast minority. We're talking about 2 to 3. Yeah.
Okay.
Out of.
Daniela Martins is a U.S. and Latin America reproductive access expert and vice chair of the Women's Emergency Network Clinic in Coral Gables. Gloria Romero Rosas is a Florida board member for the abortion rights nonprofit Catholics for Choice. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, the controversial story behind those cool new school bus cameras. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. This is National Bus Safety Week. That matters even more when you think about school buses and all the car drivers out there who run the school bus stop signs that are supposed to let kids cross the street safely. This year, many Florida school buses, like Miami-Dade County's, are now equipped with cameras that record those scofflaw motorists who then get issued $200 tickets. On the surface, that's a good thing. But beneath the surface, there appears to be a much more tawdry Florida story. This week, the Jacksonville investigative news outlet The Tributary published an in-depth report chronicling a web of potential conflicts of interest behind the legislation that allowed for the school bus cameras, and which has produced a controversial goldmine for the company that operates them called Bus Patrol. At front and center in the matter is Republican Miami State Representative Vicky Lopez, herself no stranger to controversy since her days as a convicted, then exonerated Lee County Commissioner. What do you think about the new school bus cameras here and the troubling questions surrounding them? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from Jacksonville is Nandini Srinivasan, the Tributary investigative journalist who wrote this week's report. Nandini, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm great. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Let's introduce the players in this controversy, Nandini. Let's start with the central figure, Republican State Representative Vicky Lopez, who represents District 113 here in Miami. As you point out, her election to the legislature 2 years ago represented something of a political, if not personal, comeback. Tell us about her backstory.
Yeah, I mean, when Representative Vicky Lopez won the district in 2022, I think she was the first Republican to do so in almost a decade, at least. So her comeback, it was a sort of a political comeback in that account. In the 90s, when she was both as a candidate and as a sitting commissioner for Lee County Commission, she had relationships with two lobbyists, both of whom had issues in front of the board. And so she went on to argue that those relationships were personal and not matters of public concern, even if both lobbies were hired to influence her vote.
Right. And she was convicted then on honest services charges, as it was called, no?
Yes. So honest services, the jury decided that she had used the mail to, in a way, defraud the public of Lee County. So that's what honest services fraud was. And The definition of what accounted for honest services fraud was later changed, saying you can't convict someone for honest services fraud if they're not guilty of bribery.
Right. And so as a result, her conviction was overturned.
Exactly. Right. So her conviction was overturned in 2011.
Right. So fast forward to then 2022, she wins a state representative seat over here on the other side of the peninsula in Miami. And that represents a sort of a political rehabilitation for her then, right?
Yeah. So since her conviction, she began working towards criminal justice. She became a really well-renowned criminal justice advocate, working with Jeb Bush and other officials in the Florida state. And she was also, at one point, she was an executive director for Girls Advocacy Project, wherein she again faced controversy in 2011 when state investigators said that she may have used public funds for personal expenses, including an invoice for nearly $11,000.
Right.
To a company that was run by her son.
Right. So as I said, no stranger to controversy, Vicky Lopez. But the other central player is the Bus Patrol, or the company known as Bus Patrol. Tell us about this company, what it does, and why it seems to have this chummy relationship with Vicky Lopez.
So Bus Patrol is a company that manufactures traffic cameras for school buses that law enforcement can use to issue citations for people who drive past a stopped school bus while students are crossing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Lopez co-sponsored the bill that authorized such vendors to operate in Florida, because you would require, law enforcement would require legislation to be able to cite people using those cameras. So Lopez co-sponsored that bill, and later, a few months after that bill passed, her son was hired as VP of Government Relations at Bus Patrol.
Well, I just want to stop there, Nandini, 1 second. And say, do we know why? Did she state publicly why she wanted to co-sponsor this bill? Did she give us any motivation, you know, when she was co-sponsoring it?
Well, I wish she'd spoken to us. We did reach out to her for multiple times for an interview. I really wish she'd spoken to us.
Right.
I'm not certain, but what I do know is that in her message to Angie Nixon, where she talks about her son, and where she asks her,
Nixon being a colleague legislator up in Tallahassee.
Yeah, Angie Nixon, who's I think she's representing Jacksonville here.
Right.
So when she reached out to this legislator, she did say that, quote, "I thought you might be supportive of child safety."
Okay, so she was asserting this as child safety then. So but we should point out, though, that school officials and law enforcement in Florida counties like Miami-Dade did feel the need for this kind of traffic surveillance. I mean, a lot of Miami and Florida drivers do recklessly ignore school bus stop sign arms, right?
I mean, we don't dispute that. Of course, that's something that we need. We need an accountability system for people who drive past stop school buses to protect our students, right?
Right.
How are we making that accountability system is what we wanted to focus on in our story. How is that system formed?
So as you report, after the school bus camera law takes effect, Vicky Lopez's stepson, Donnie Wolf, suddenly appears as the vice president of government relations for the very company that dominates the school bus camera market here, Bus Patrol. What sort of flags did this raise in Tallahassee or elsewhere?
I'm actually not sure if it raised any, to be honest. Because we did reach out to Vicky Lopez and asked her, because she voted on a bill earlier this year that expanded how Bus Patrol could make money. Now Bus Patrol can make money off of citations, right?
Right. Yeah, and we should point out that as a result of that subsequent legislation that she sponsored, Bus Patrol now can take a pretty hefty chunk of those $200 or so fines that a driver is levied if he or she does go through one of those school bus stop signs, right?
Yes. So I'm pretty certain in Miami they get to keep a majority of that amount, and so by the end of the school. Not even by the end of the school year, within a month, they could make as much as $3 million But what, but to get back to what I was trying to say is that,
about her stepson, you were speaking about, right?
Yes. So about red flags in Tallahassee, right? So
sure.
When we reached out to her and asked her, did you ever disclose a voting conflict? She said she had consulted with the House General Counsel. We haven't been able to find any reports about that. We did ask her saying, did you have any minutes of that meeting, or did you have any notes of that meeting or anything that was written down that you could share with us? And she and her a representative did not respond.
Right. Now, we here at the South Florida Roundup did reach out to Representative Lopez this week to hear her response to all this. Her office told us she was busy campaigning for re-election and could not respond to us. But I'll point out that for your investigative article, Nandini, Lopez's campaign advisor did issue a statement insisting that Lopez's relatives, like her stepson, Donnie Wolf, did not gain employment at Bus Patrol due to the legislation she introduced, but rather, quote, on their own merits. Is that a correct assessment of how they responded to you?
Yes, that is. They did say that her son got off his own merits, and I'm not here. It's not my place to dispute that. What I would say is that Lopez, when she voted on the bill expanding their revenue, expanding Bus Patrol's revenue methods earlier this year, she did not disclose. And that is something that experts that I've spoken to said she should have.
Okay. Well, we have a caller from Coral Gables. Ian, you have some input on this subject that you'd like to share with us. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hey, afternoon. I just worry that this is going to be used as an excuse down the line if this does blow up in any way to roll back some of these speed camera provisions or bus passing violation automated systems. I do drive partially for a living, and and also just as someone who lives in the U.S. where traffic fatalities are at a record high as of last year, the more enforcement the better. The more automated enforcement, I think, is just better for police because it lets them focus on more important things.
Right. No, that's a great point, Ian. Thanks, and I do want to get to that a little later in our discussion, Nandini. But first, this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Nandini Srinivasan, investigative reporter for the Tributary in Jacksonville, about the controversy surrounding those new school bus cameras in Florida counties like Miami-Dade. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Nandini, let's then go to the issue then of how lucrative this has become for Bus Patrol, a company, let's remember, that Vicky Lopez's relatives have high-profile jobs at. You mentioned that Bus Patrol is potentially earning about more than $3 million a month as a result of this, no?
Yes, and that's only in Miami-Dade. They also have contracts with Hillsborough, and there they could be making, I think, up to $1 million a month.
Right. So real quickly, let's look at the other facet of your investigation here, and that's Bus Patrol itself. While people, of course, are glad to see school bus stop sign violators punished, there is another big controversy raging here about how fairly Bus Patrol's equipment monitors drivers, right? Not just here in Florida, but around the country, especially in New York?
Yes, exactly. So Newsday, an excellent investigative newsroom based in Long Island, I believe they did a lot of reporting about Bus Patrol in New York. I do have to mention that New York Mayor Eric Adams, one of his deputy mayor's aides, is currently the president of Bus Patrol as well. And
Deeper, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, we do have those conflicts that keep getting deeper across the country. There have been issues. There is currently a class action lawsuit saying that Bus Patrol did not give enough evidence for a citation to be issued.
Right.
Right.
And we did reach out to Bus Patrol ourselves. They sent us a statement saying, quote, the recent Tributary story, meaning your story, Nandini, contains misleading and inaccurate information about our company. Our focus is on school bus safety and our record is strong. We follow every rule and law at the local, state and federal level. I would imagine, Nandini, that Bus Patrol's critics don't agree with that, no?
Bus patrols critics have generally called the, and they have in New York as well, and you can see in prior reporting as well, that they've called bus patrol system essentially a cash grab, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, which brings
that's
me
been
which,
the major criticism that
right,
bus patrol.
Which brings me to my last question then for you, Nandini. This inevitably is going to remind folks here, as our caller Ian pointed out earlier. This is going to remind folks here of the controversy surrounding the red light cameras so many municipalities have installed, which are now being dismantled in so many of those same places because citizens decided there was a lot of unfairness in the way the cameras were used and that these local governments were just using them as revenue generators or cash cows, as you said, more than safety methods. Does the controversy surrounding bus patrol and its relationship with a highly scrutinized politician like Vicky Lopez threaten to result in the same fate for school bus cameras, do you think?
I think that scrutiny is good. I think that scrutiny of legislation, scrutiny on our vendors, scrutiny on how these citations are being issued is good. And that the more scrutiny we have, the more we finesse that process.
Right. So again, we come to a situation of, you know, a well-intentioned approach here. Sort of, you know, we're taking a step back and scrutinizing it more. That's as a result, for example, of your great investigative reporter. Nandini Srinivasan is an investigative reporter at the Tributary in Jacksonville. Nandini, congrats on the great reporting and many thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Still to come, will the last one out of Cuba turn the lights back on, please? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. It was exactly 1 week ago that the lights went out in Cuba. Again. But this time, the blackout was massive. For days, the entire island was without power as panicked communist officials tried to fix their decrepit electric grid, a product of the regime's equally decrepit economic system. Some power has since been restored, including in the capital, Havana, but most of Cuba's more than 10 million residents, especially in rural areas, are still in the dark. The government, of course, blames the U.S. economic embargo against Cuba for its struggles to fuel and maintain the island's power plants. But the real question is how and why Cuba ever let the problem get this bad, and if, at this point, it can ever really fix the situation without a major structural reforms, which, as we know, is not something the Cuban Revolution is all that good at. Do you have family or friends in Cuba caught in the epic blackout? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Miami journalist David Adams, a veteran Cuba reporter who was there this year and saw all the disrepair up close, meaning he's not all that surprised by what's happening now. His reporting on the crisis appeared this week in the New York Times. David, how are you?
Good to talk with you, Tim.
As always, David. So as I said, this crisis started last Friday morning. Remind folks, please, what caused the meltdown? Ground Zero seems to have been a thermoelectric plant at Matanzas, east of Havana, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's one of the big ones. There's eight large thermoelectrical power stations in Cuba that provide the bulk of the energy. They're all very old, sort of 50-year-old Soviet-era stations, and they are oil-fired. And so Cuba relies almost entirely on the supply of fuel, the import of fuel, some domestic production,
right,
to fuel those stations. And one of the big problems they have is that they keep breaking down because Cuba produces a heavy sulfurous fuel, and it tends to burn up all of the metallurgy in the plants, which leads to these breakdowns.
Yeah, and as you pointed out in your article, Cuba only produces about 40,000 barrels per day of its own oil, but consumes three times that much per day and has to rely on allies like Venezuela, Russia, or China to help make up that difference, which is very difficult, right?
Yes, absolutely. When, you know, if your ally is Venezuela, we all know that Venezuela's been having huge problems with its oil exports due to U.S. sanctions and its own domestic production problems, similar to, in a way, to Cuba. You know,
right. And now the Cuban government really didn't seem to get a handle on this until about Monday or so, when Havana started getting power again. What does the situation look like around the country now, David? What are we hearing from Cubans on the ground there about what they're experiencing and how they're getting through this in terms of basics, like, you know, keeping food fresh, hospital services, things of that nature?
Well, if you'll excuse the pun, we're a little bit in the dark about the situation,
to say
in
the least,
the countryside.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Havana, yes, power is back on with, they're back to kind of the usual situation, which was power cuts on a daily basis for several hours a day, rolling power cuts. So at least it's sort of, there's some system to it, although it's gotten very unpredictable. In the countryside, there's much less energy available. The power cuts tend to be longer. And yes, obviously, a lot of people lost food in their fridges. I mean, I was talking to one guy who was borrowing energy with an extension cable from a neighbor who was a retired diplomat and had a generator. And so he could periodically power up his fridge and his cell phone, desperately trying to keep some of the meat that he had bought in the market a few days earlier, right, fresh in his fridge.
No, there's a panic, no doubt. But going back to the problems that we were just talking about, even Cuban economists say that the country is virtually bankrupt and really can no longer pay for all of that oil to generate electricity that you and I were just talking about to fuel the grid. Now, the Cuban regime, of course, blames the U.S. embargo for hindering its ability to improve the island's electrical grid. And it is hard to just dismiss that argument. But just how much of this, David, is the embargo, and how much of it is the communist regime's inability, if not unwillingness, to modernize the woefully outdated economic and administrative system that undergirds that grid and everything else in Cuba?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't want to sort of put a percentage on, you know, which is more to blame. The embargo certainly it does handicap Cuba. There's no question, and not just because of the embargoes on the island and on its allies like Venezuela or Russia, but also on tankers that carry fuel. Mm-hmm. But yes, they have kind of ignored the infrastructure problem. They have invested all of their foreign currency practically in hotels. Unfortunately for Cuba, those hotels are now largely empty. They have been since COVID. They've never really, the tourist industry has never really recovered. The U.S. Sanctions on Cuba that were slapped back by President Trump after President Obama opened tourism up to the cruise ships industry, and Americans were flocking there. So the hotels were all full. There were even Americans investing in hotels in Cuba. Right. That all came to an end. So all of that money, in a way, that has been invested in the Cuban hotel industry has sort of gone to waste, and that money could have been invested in modernizing its energy infrastructure.
Yeah, that brings me to my next question. You point out in your New York Times article, for example, that given its gross over-reliance on fossil fuels to generate electricity, which it really can't pay for anymore, you'd think that by now the regime would have gotten more serious about developing renewable energy. It says it wants at least a quarter of the island's power to come from renewable sources like wind and solar by the end of this decade, and yet right now less than 5% of it is renewable. What's holding things back?
Yeah, they've actually increased their goals to 37% by 2030.
Great.
And as you said, it's only 5%. The problem is they don't, as we were just discussing, they don't have the money to invest in these major projects. China has offered to build 92 solar farms, adding 2,000 megawatts, which would be a significant contribution to its grid. But there's you know, huge questions on the financing. The Chinese don't give money away. They want something in return. And then the other issue is that Cuba has kept the lid on private investment.
Yeah.
The private sector could be providing some of this solar energy if there were mechanisms in place to allow for investment in the private sector.
Which the regime keeps tamping down.
Exactly.
Right.
So what the government has said this week is, encouraging Cubans with family abroad to get them to send solar panels,
right,
which they can hook up.
Which is
certainly a good idea.
Right.
That there's no embargo on anything like that, as far as I'm aware.
Right.
But the question is, you know, you can't just put solar panels on American Airlines and fly them to Cuba and expect to resolve the problem.
Well, exactly. Even though the Cuban government a few years ago did eliminate any duty, import duties on solar panels coming into the island, right?
That's true. So a lot of, one of the ironies of this whole situation is that the Cuban government now says that it's Cubans abroad sending generators and air conditioners to Cuba, as well as,
right,
modern TVs and all kinds of electrical goods that they say is now overloading the system, because
right,
they say the system collapsed
right,
due to an overload, whereas the population, by most estimates, has gone down by 1 million in the last 3 or 4 years because of the massive exodus of
You're
migrants
right
from Cuba.
It is ironic. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with veteran Miami journalist and Cuba reporter David Adams about the causes and fallout of the communist island's epic blackout. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, David, this catastrophe is likely to have political fallout too, as everything always does in Cuba. Over the weekend, we saw residents in Havana start to take to the streets with pots and pans to protest this protracted blackout. And the main focus of their anger was President Miguel Díaz-Canel. He dismissed the demonstrators as being, quote, drunk, which didn't seem to be the smartest of responses for a president. But either way, civilian leaders like Díaz-Canel and Prime Minister Manuel Marrero would seem to be in the crosshairs of Cuba's older military bosses right now. No, what does their fate look like?
Well, it hasn't gone unnoticed that President Díaz-Canel has been wearing a military uniform the last
right,
few days.
Yes,
he doesn't hold a military rank, although everyone in Cuba kind of serves in the military because they have national conscription.
Right.
He is obviously trying to look the part. And I think most Cubans understand that if they do protest, then the government is going to crack down hard. We all saw that in July of 2021. Cubans voted with their feet. They left the country. A lot of the dissidents have left Cuba under threat of jail. A lot of journalists lately, we've seen a big crackdown on journalists lately, some of whom have fled the country rather than face interrogation under Cuba's new media laws, which basically make it illegal to work for any non-state media outlet.
Right.
So I don't see a great likelihood of another July 2021 outbreak of civil unrest, as long as the Cubans can keep the power on and keep it
right,
sort of modestly restored as they have now.
In
another breakdown?
Yeah, but in the 30 seconds we have left, David, is that possible? Are they going to resolve this, or are we just going to keep seeing more blackouts like this?
Well, as Cuban Spanish speakers in your audience know well, resolver in Spanish is kind of the motto of Cubans, has been for decades.
We'll see if they can resolver this. We're out of time here, David, but thanks. David Adams is a Miami journalist who has reported on Cuba for more than 30 years. David, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, it's official. Taylor Swift's concerts produce more wealth than the GDP of the Pacific Island nation of Tuvalu. According to Visit Lauderdale, Broward County's tourism marketing agency, Swift's concerts at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens last weekend generated $80 million for South Florida's economy. The three sold-out shows were attended by more than 350,000 people, 70% of whom traveled here from outside South Florida. That means a lot of hotel, restaurant, and Uber spending, and pretty high-end spending when you consider the celebrity roster in the audience, including the likes of Tom Brady, Serena Williams, Billy Joel, and Today Show host Hoda Kotb and Savannah Guthrie. Miami kicked off the final leg of Swift's record-breaking Eras Tour, which is expected to earn $1 billion. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.